Chapter 3. Into the Crypt.
You passed out.
Lucy blinked several times, her eyes adjusting to the candlelight. The room around her was unfamiliar, as was the woman leaning over her.
You passed out right after...
The woman fell silent and looked away. Lucy came to her senses with a jolt. The boy.
Where is he? Where's the boy? Demanded Lucy.
I'm so sorry. He didn't make it, replied the woman. Lucy slumped back into the bed, her head spinning. She'd saved the boy's life, and then allowed him to die. If only she'd checked his backpack. If only he'd have told her something, anything.
Drink this, insisted the woman, lifting Lucy's head up a little and putting a straw to her lips.
Lucy took a few sips before abandoning the carton, overcome by nausea and guilt.
You're dehydrated, and you need to rest, advised the woman. I'll leave the drink here. Sleep now.
Lucy tried to sit up, feeling like she had to do something to make amends for the boy, or Toby, or Dan. But she was disoriented and weak from all that had happened. The woman pinned her down firmly, shaking her head with weary disapproval.
Girl, I told you already, you're not fit to move. You get up now and you'll cause nothing but more trouble. You need to sleep.
Sometime later, Lucy awoke from her exhausted slumber. The curt woman was nowhere to be seen. Rubbing her eyes, she took in her candlelit surroundings properly. The ceiling was low and made of stone. Dozens of camp beds and mattresses filled the space. Lucy stifled a gasp as she realized there were other people asleep in the room with her. She immediately began looking around for an exit. The single doorway across the room led to a set of steps that disappeared from view. At the foot of her bed, folded, was a fresh set of clothes. Next to that was her backpack, and the Asian woman's boots she'd scavenged from the train. The rest of the sports drink had disappeared. Lucy gasped as she leaned forwards to pick up the clothes, remembering her broken ribs. The bed creaked loudly. Someone across the room rustled, turning over to lie on their other side. She swiveled out from under the quilt as quietly as she could and realized she was still wearing Toby's rolled-up cargo pants. Lucy pulled the stolen boots on and steadied herself as she stood. Picking up the pile of fresh clothes, she edged towards the exit, backpack swung over her shoulder. At the top of the short stone staircase was a heavy-looking wooden door. It was unlocked, and as Lucy pushed it open, she emerged onto the floor of the town hall.
Excuse me, she said, approaching a kindly-looking woman.
The woman was extremely large and wore a baggy, unbuttoned cloth shirt over a stained white t-shirt. Her red hair was tied back in a ponytail, and she was carrying a pile of folded towels.
You're the new one, noted the woman, eyeing Lucy suspiciously.
Yeah, I guess that's me.
Sorry about your boy, replied the woman, setting off again.
He wasn't my... Thanks, replied Lucy, quick-stepping to catch up. Is there somewhere I could get changed? They reached another mottled door across the hall, which was covered in flaking, faded cream paint. Continuing through, they stepped into a gloomy corridor with dark, wooden-paneled walls and an aging red carpet.
Bathroom's down that way. Do not use the toilet unless you want to be pulling it back out again, said the woman, who immediately departed the way she'd come.
Oh, thanks, said Lucy. I didn't catch your... The flaking cream door swung closed. Lucy set off down the corridor. Old oil paintings depicted scenes from the Civil War alongside portraits of aged white men she didn't recognize. If the cold stone floor of the bathroom wasn't enough of an incentive for her to hurry, the smell certainly was. She changed as quickly as her delicate ribs would allow and returned to the main hall, her dirty clothes shoved inside her backpack. The hall was large with a high ceiling and an elevated balcony level which looked down on the central floor.
And I thought we had it bad, came a familiar voice from the far side of the hall.
Lucy jolted, realizing she was being addressed.
I'm Paul, the council leader, the man continued, walking towards her. And you must be Lucy.
She recognized him. He was the man who'd tried to save the boy. Lucy's eyes widened as she saw that tucked under his arm was her notebook.
How did you get that?
She cried, swiveling her backpack off and immediately rifling through it.
We searched your stuff after you passed out. Seemed only prudent. And I'm glad we did. I was going to put you to work in the fields with Sammy, but it looks like we've got a few things to discuss. It's not in there, he added as she continued to rummage. Your gun, I mean. Just a precaution. When we know we can trust you, you'll get it back. We're not savages. Lucy stared at him in amazement. I want you to tell me everything you know about those creatures. Then I want you to brief the council on it, said Paul, solemnly returning the notebook to her.
Paul! Came a cry from across the hall.
What is it? He said, turning around. A woman rushed over to them and held out a radio.
It's Watchtower 2. They've got new arrivals. They say they need you urgently.
Again? Paul took the receiver from her hand. Go ahead, Tower 2. This is Paul. The radio crackled back into life as the response came through.
You better get down here, boss. We've got two new arrivals. They're from county.
Lucy thought she recognized the voice. The name Maddie came to mind. Had he rescued her and the boy?
They're armed, boss, and they're demanding to see you,
the familiar voice crackled.
Understood. On my way, replied Paul.
Come with me, he instructed Lucy.
Me? Okay. By county, did he mean?
She stammered, following him out of the hall.
The prison? I'm guessing so, he replied, heading towards a nearby car. And by the sounds of it, they aren't exactly the guards.
He rocked into the driver's seat.
Get in already, said Paul, buckling up his seatbelt. You can start briefing me on the way.
Lucy obeyed. So you were on the evac train? He asked, starting the engine and pulling out.
Yes, I...
Which makes you some sort of expert, he interrupted. We need that. We've done what we can with guesswork. You probably figured that out with the whole vault sleeping thing.
We're here to defend ourselves, Lucy. And we are struggling. But with your help...
He peered through the grimy windshield as he took them around a corner. The last leader died a week or so ago, he continued. She lasted all of 2 days. I was the new deputy, so, well, you can see how that worked out. I'm a high school teacher by trade, though. History. I'm not a scientist like you. But I dare say I've more in common with you than most of the other folk left round here.
Lucy gave a polite smile and looked down, twiddling the straps of her backpack, which sat nestled between her legs.
We had a rough night, Paul went on. One of the other watchtowers was attacked, and we lost 2 men. I'm in half a mind to scrap the whole watch roster entirely and just keep everyone in the vault.
They haven't found you in there? Said Lucy, mulling over the composition of the stone chamber.
Would we be having this conversation if they had? Said Paul with a harsh laugh. It seems to keep us safe.
If the vault keeps you safe, why are you bothering with watchtowers?
Paul raised an eyebrow. Are you for real? When desperate people know what you have, they'll try and take it from you. I read your diary. I'd have thought you'd learned that lesson by now.
Lucy's mind flashed back to Dan showing her the broken apartment door and their stolen rations. She grabbed both of her thighs and gripped hard as the aching loss of Dan soared to the front of her mind.
You okay? Said Paul, looking at her warily, like she was about to throw up in his taxi.
Fine, she replied, exhaling slowly and counting to 3 under her breath. So your watchtowers are to defend you against other people?
Bingo, said Paul, slapping the wheel. The boys up there have got night vision goggles.
So they've seen the creatures?
A couple have. It depends on how many you're hunting. If it's just one, the tower can usually handle it. If it's a whole pack, then we lose every time.
The bodies from last night, were they killed by beasts or humans?
Paul glanced at her. Beasts? Why?
You need to burn their bodies.
Bit late for that. We've already buried them.
Lucy felt a pang in her stomach. Then you need to dig them up.
Are you kidding me? Why in God's name would I do that? We knew those people. Some of their family are still alive. A stunt like that's just going to bring them pain.
Listen to me, said Lucy, pivoting in her seat to face Paul properly. How long have you left a body before burying it, one that was killed by a beast?
We bury them pretty quick, all within a day.
How about when the pathogen was airborne? I'm seeing a lot more houses here than people, so I'm guessing you guys suffered what we went through in San Fran?
You mean the virus, replied Paul.
Lucy opened, then closed her mouth, deciding not to correct him.
Back then, folk were dying too quick for us to bury them all the same day, he continued.
So you've seen them rot. You've seen them turn to water? Paul eyed her suspiciously. The airborne pathogen, virus, let's call it, was part of the same thing as the creatures now attacking us, explained Lucy. They're linked, and the bodies decay the same way, only much quicker if they've been killed by a beast.
What's your point? Said Paul, taking another corner.
My point is the bodies turn to water. Gen water is what it's being called. There was a hypothesis discussed on the train that the water is part of the creature's metabolism. It's their food.
So we should burn the bodies? Said Paul, bemused.
Those things will be coming back to feed, I'm sure of it. You need to destroy their food source before that. Dig the bodies up and burn them. Though it might be too late now.
How's about one crisis at a time, hey? Said Paul as they approached Watchtower 2.
Lucy recognized the outpost from her arrival the day before, this time having experienced the town in reverse order. Her own insider status here was dubious at best, but she felt a pang of defensiveness when she saw the strangers stood at the threshold to the town. She didn't want them in. Maybe it had something to do with the orange jumpsuits both of them were wearing, or the fact that each held an assault rifle. Paul slowed the car to a stop and got out, Lucy following.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name's Paul,
he began, striking a formal tone, but stopping short of a handshake. The two men eyed him suspiciously. They were big guys, the kind of guys who spent their entire prison sentence working out, and judging by the size of their triceps, they'd been behind bars for a while. The shorter of the two convicts spoke first. He had a thick handlebar mustache, Caucasian skin, and a shaven head. Tattoos crept above the neckline of his jumpsuit, licking at the base of his skull.
You in charge around here? He demanded.
I am, replied Paul.
To the side of Paul stood Maddie and Rich, each holding a weapon of their own. Maddie a revolver, Rich a shotgun. Neither moved, neither blinked. Both stared, cold as day. It was clear to Lucy why they'd been selected for watch duty.
My friend here and me would be most grateful if you could extend us your hospitality and allow us to shelter here with y'all, continued the tattooed man.
That can be discussed, said Paul, but not at gunpoint. Lower your weapons and we'll talk about it.
Much as I'd like to do that, replied the mustachioed skinhead. You can see why, from where I'm standing, that would be a very dumb move on our parts. What's to say you're not going to blow off our heads as soon as we do?
Rich, said Paul, as he put a hand to Rich's shotgun, lowering the barrel away from the tall convict's chest. You may enter here if you abide by our rules. It's as simple as that, said Paul, addressing the convicts once again.
Boss, they're convicts, cried Maddie, incredulously, his gun still trained on the pair. They don't give a shit about rules. They've already broken the law.
Hey, protested the smaller man. Call your boy off.
After you've lowered your weapons, Paul replied.
The skinhead considered for a moment, then slowly lowered his gun, raising his spare hand in a peaceful gesture. After a pause, the barrel-chested guy behind him did the same. Both convicts stood, their orange jumpsuits the brightest things on the entire horizon, a rifle hanging by each man's side, and an arm uplifted in surrender. Lower your rifles to the ground, please, so that Maddie here can collect them, instructed Paul.
How come he ain't lowered his weapon? Protested the tattooed skinhead.
If we were gonna shoot you, we'd have done it already, said Paul. Relax. We're gonna take your weapons is all. Then we'll see about getting you fellas some water. Now put your rifles on the ground, please.
The two convicts slowly complied.
Back up. Back up a few paces more, barked Maddie as he edged towards the abandoned guns.
Rich stood stony-faced as his colleague retrieved the weapons, poised to shoot should either of the convicts move too quickly.
Okay, I think we have an understanding.
Welcome to Wilson, gentlemen, declared Paul, without a smile this time.
I need water,
declared the barrel-chested man, his deep voice complimenting the dark cornrows adorning his head.
Sir,
he added resentfully after a dig in the ribs from his companion.
I'm sure you could both use some food and drink. That can be arranged, replied Paul.
We will need to keep you in cuffs until the council has had a chance to meet and discuss the level of freedom we can offer you. But I see no reason why, if we can gain mutual trust, the two of you cannot become contributors to the safety and survival of this town. There was a stunned silence on both sides.
The two men stood and gawped at what Paul was saying, the message of being recuffed sticking in their throats. Along with them, Rich's stony face was now practically cracked in two, his jaw hanging wide open as his leader offered two escaped convicts room, board, and possibly a free rein in their town. "You see that building up ahead?" said Paul, pointing down the straight road leading into town. "That's the town hall. I'll meet you there in about 25 minutes. That's how long it should take you to walk. There you'll find food and water."
"Why can't we get a ride in your car?"
chimed the skinhead, pointing at Lucy. "Like I said, it's not a long walk, and we'll see you there, gentlemen," said Paul as Maddie loaded their confiscated weapons into the trunk. Paul chucked Maddie a pair of heavy-duty cable ties, then climbed back behind the wheel. "Get up to put the cuffs on each other," he said, leaning back out of the window. "Then check their tight." "You got it," said Maddie. Lucy clipped in her seatbelt as they did a U-turn and headed back towards the center. "Will they be all right?" she said nervously, looking back at Rich and Maddie with the two convicts in the rearview mirror. "Those two could handle themselves. Don't you worry about that. Rich served in Iraq. We have a meeting to organize, though. The council will need to vote on what we do with those two convicts. Which is a pain, because it means I've got to pull a bunch of people off their day stations." They collected a couple of the counselors en route and arrived to find the rest waiting at the town hall, where there was a great deal of commotion. Word of the new arrivals had spread fast. Paul and the other collected counselors made their way into the private meeting room with Lucy in tow, leaving behind the inquisitive, gossiping congregation. The council entered a small side room and took its seats. Two archaic windows at opposing ends of the room were the only sources of illumination. The two shafts of pale light met across a large oval table that dominated the inadequate space. Paul took his seat at the head of the table and gestured to Lucy to sit immediately by him. It wasn't until the rest of the council had taken their places that she realized she was literally at his right-hand side. The man opposite Lucy, on Paul's left, was evidently the scribe, being the only one bearing pen and paper. Neighboring him was a rotund, stern-looking woman in her 50s, and an aging, mostly toothless man in dungarees. To Lucy's immediate right was a red-haired man who was followed by another 50-something white woman and a Latina woman in her 40s. Thanks to Lucy's presence, her side of the table now numbered 4 instead of 3. The 7 counselors ranged in age from their mid-30s through to their early 70s. There were 4 men and 3 women, plus Lucy.
"Before we begin," said the rotund woman diagonally opposite Lucy, "I want to know who she is and why she's allowed in here."
Her objection earned murmurs of approval from other counselors.
"This is Lucy," replied Paul. "She's a national scientific expert and was on the West Coast evac train. She's not here to vote. Once we've discussed the prisoners' fates, she will be briefing us."
"Briefing us?"
spluttered the mostly toothless septuagenarian from behind his dungarees.
"Yes, Jerry," sighed Paul. "She knows things we don't, and in order for us all to stay alive and beat those creatures, we're going to need to suck up our pride and actually listen for once."
Jerry leaned back in his seat and folded his arms, casting Lucy the filthiest of looks. Lucy swallowed nervously as more raised eyebrows and suspicious mutterings proliferated around the small room.
"Turning to the matter at hand," continued Paul from the head of the table, "I will now restate the situation for the record."
The slightly plump, goatee-wearing scribe began to scribble as Paul spoke. "Two escaped convicts arrived in our town this afternoon asking for food, water, and shelter. They were disarmed peacefully and agreed to wear cable-tie cuffs until they reach the hall, where they will be fed. This extraordinary meeting of the council has been called by Council Leader Paul Tillerman so that a decision may be reached as to the status and future of these two men in Wilson." He paused, waiting for the scribe to catch up.
"Can you repeat that last bit?" pleaded the chubby clerk.
Paul groaned, slumping back in his chair.
"We need to vote on what to do with the prisoners.
Fiona, I imagine you've got an opinion on this,"
he said, addressing the rotund objector diagonally opposite Lucy.
"You're darned right I do. They're not staying here, that's for sure,"
she retorted, glaring around the table, daring someone to challenge her.
They're a danger to the whole community. We'd have to feed them, obviously, and why the hell should we do that? Heaven knows what they did to escape prison.
Or what they did to get there in the first place,
whistled the tooth-deprived Jerry.
Precisely, rattled Fiona. We don't know who they've hurt or killed, even. We can't let them roam freely around our town, around our children.
Murmurs of approval and nods passed around the room.
But where do we send them? Asked the Latina woman at the far end of Lucy's row.
Back the way they came, Andrea,
retorted Fiona defiantly.
Or we could put them on the road to another town,
suggested the chubby scribe to Paul's left, peering up from his frantic jotting.
Give them some food and water for the journey. That will get rid of them.
Oh, this is madness, interjected the red-haired man on Lucy's immediate right. What town? Where are they going to go? You know as well as I do that if you send them away on foot, you might as well go right ahead and sign their death warrants. If the creatures don't get them, the exposure will. Or dehydration.
He thumped the table with his fist.
There's nowhere left round here, and you know it.
I hate to break it to you, Dawn, but this is what they deserve, retorted Fiona vehemently. They chose to break the law, after all, and now this is part of the punishment.
I couldn't disagree with you more. Don's curly hair flailed as he emphatically shook his head. This is a chance to reintegrate them, to rehabilitate them. It's the civilized thing to do.
Don has a point, said the thin-faced white woman next to him, speaking for the first time. Those men are strong. They could be useful. I mean, we need more hands for hauling timber, right? And we're already behind on the winter fuel schedule.
But how can we trust them? Are you really telling me, Monica, that you'd be happy letting two escaped prisoners wander around town? Be around your kids? Sleep in the same room as all of us?
Maybe we could arrange some sort of supervision of them?
Monica countered, her shoulders hunching together. Andrea and Dawn nodded either side of her, muttering their approval.
In that case, you might as well build a new prison for them here,
countered the scribe, nervously twiddling his goatee.
I mean, that's basically what you're saying, isn't it?
I'm saying, replied Monica, her voice laced with exasperation, I don't want to just exile these men to the wilderness. They're human beings, but I get the concerns the others are raising, she conceded, flopping back into her seat dejectedly.
Oh, shove it, Monica. This is such a load of bull, said Fiona, losing her cool. It is not bull. Just say what you actually mean. Those men have no place here, thundered Fiona.
Whoa, let's keep it civil, people, intervened Paul. We've got to reach a decision. I understand the concerns around the table. I don't believe we have the resources to monitor the two men if we keep them here. So as I see it, it's between accepting them as equal citizens and integrating them into our town, treating them as an asset, not a threat, as Monica originally suggested, or, and I think it would be barbaric of us to go down this route myself, the alternative option, which is to exile them. Time to put it to the vote. Exile or integrate? All in favor of exiling the men, raise your hand.
Fiona and Jerry's hands went up without hesitation, meekly followed by a reluctant third vote from the goateed scribe.
And all in favor of integrating the prisoners, raise your hand.
Paul surveyed the room again. Four hands went up immediately this time, including his own. With their hands held high, Dawn, Monica, and Andrea glared across the table at their three ideological adversaries. Lucy didn't move.
The motion is passed, said Paul. The men will be reintegrated with immediate effect and will no longer be referred to as prisoners, he said conclusively.
Two gunshots rang out from within the main hall, followed by screams and stampeding footsteps. The counselors rushed out of the meeting room and into the nearly deserted hall. Lucy stuck close to Paul in the midst of the commotion, while the last of the congregants fled to the street. At the side of the hall, the two convicts lay crumpled on the floor in front of a bench. Each lay cuffed, with a bullet in his head. A shared pool of blood seeped into the stone beneath. Above them stood Maddie, trembling.
"Christ, Maddie, what have you done?" cried Paul, aghast.
Mingling with the blood were the remnants of the prisoners' meals, which had fallen to the ground.
They were bad men, said Maddie in a strained, high-pitched voice.
He was twitching, imploring, casting his eyes around the horrified faces of the counselors.
Bad men,
he reiterated, weeping now, trembling from his head to foot, with the handgun dangling pathetically at his side. Don, the red-haired counselor, stepped out from the group and made his way over to Maddie. Placing a consoling hand on the weeping man's shoulder, he took the revolver without meeting resistance.
"I'm sorry,"
pleaded the distraught Maddie through a mass of tears.
"I'm sorry, Don. I didn't know what else to do. I had to protect us," he choked.
Don led Maddie away to the side, where he sat him down in a chair and slid a set of cable ties around the weeping man's clasped hands. Outside, a crowd was gathering, drawn to the commotion. The cries of bystanders warned people off entering. The counselor stood, spellbound for a moment, until Paul retook the lead.
"Fiona, organize a cleanup team in here immediately. We need to mop up the blood, then bleach the stone. Burn the rags once your team's done mopping. Don," he said, turning to the red-haired counselor, "I need you to arrange disposal of the two bodies. We can't bury them anymore. We need to burn them."
"I know they were prisoners," protested Monica, "but that's unholy, Paul. They're people. They deserve to be buried."
"I agree, Monica," implored the leader, "but in 24 hours, their bodies will have degraded into food for the beasts. And what do animals do when they've buried food? They come back for it. Maybe days later, maybe months, but they know where to find it. Burning is the only way we can keep ourselves safe."
"So what, Paul? We gonna dig up all the other bodies we buried in the last 3 weeks?"
cried Fiona, weighing in.
"You gonna dig up my mama? You gonna dig up my son?"
Other townspeople were starting to murmur with concern.
"Yes, Fiona, and we'll have to dig up my wife, too," said Paul bitterly. "So please don't give me that. I know exactly what I'm suggesting. We will do what we have to in order to survive. But tonight, our priority is this goddamn mess. Andrea," he continued, turning to the Latino councilwoman, "I need you to put together a second cleanup team and follow Don. Every drop of blood between here and their cremation needs to be gone. Understood?"
Lucy stared at the victims' bodies, their vivid orange jumpsuits, their useless, bulging muscles.
"Everyone else," ordered Paul, "get the folk outside back to their workstations. We need to stay on schedule. There will be a lot of rumors spreading, and it's your duty to tell them factually what has happened. I will arrange supervision for Maddie. The council will meet again before nightfall, and we will discuss his sentence."
The town was split over Maddie's fate. Half regarded him as dangerous and his actions unforgivable, while others regarded him as a true defender of the town. Paul had been petitioned by people on both sides of the divide throughout the afternoon, and this was continuing as the evening set in. Maddie's supporters were highly vocal in their proclamations that he should be freed immediately. By contrast, the man's opponents were quieter in their protest, clustering at the sidelines to cast their disapproval. Their cumulative whispers and fearful glances only added to the undercurrent of fear. The guilty man himself sat in the shadows at the side of the hall, head stooped, mouth hanging open, staring emptily at the floor. On either side of him sat supporters, routinely broadcasting the unequivocal virtue of his actions with an almost jingoistic fervor. Yesterday, the town had seemed like an oasis, a place of sanctuary. But as Lucy looked around the hall now, she saw only a tinderbox on the brink of combustion. One ill-judged comment could spark an outright confrontation that would take every human inside down with it. As the evening weighed on, Paul eventually announced that the council would be postponing sentencing until the following day. Lucy watched the hall's entrance as people continued to trickle in, beckoned by the town's curfew bell, which two giggling young girls were taking great delight in ringing. Lucy joined the food line, shuffling along until she gratefully received her portion of stew. She sat at the side and watched in amazement as the town peacefully fell into its evening routine, while just a mile away the bodies of two murdered prisoners were still burning. Wilson's original population must have been no more than 1,000 or so, smaller than Fraser. Judging by the turnout in the hall and the number of beds in the crypt directly below, there were only around 100 of them left. Once they'd eaten, a skeleton crew remained above ground to clear away the dishes, while the rest of the town descended into the crypt. Lucy made a point of staying above ground to help with the clear-up. After dinner, a handful of adults stood outside the church smoking, eking out the last precious minutes of daylight until a second bell signaled time was up. Lucy watched as the stragglers retreated into the hall, its heavy doors quickly barred behind them. By now, the foodstuff had been cleared away, and she and the other cleaners made their way down into the vault, while Fiona, the rotund counselor, extinguished the candles in the hall. Once everyone was inside the vault, two men placed huge timber beams into recently added fittings, which horizontally barred the thick wooden door. The room was secure, but there was no second exit. Lucy carefully negotiated her way through the rows of people until she reached her previous spot. She climbed into bed without changing her clothes. The few candles illuminating the vault were extinguished in turn until just one remained alight by the entrance. The room was immensely claustrophobic now that there were almost 100 bodies crammed inside. It was a jungle of grunts, snores, and shuffles. There was the occasional wave of children crying as one set off the others. All was compounded by the rising temperature and the cocktail of scents that came to mingle in the cramped, badly ventilated haven. A few pockets of people chatted among themselves for a couple hours past the lights-out time, whispering, laughing, and guffawing to the frustrated huffs and muttered curses of everyone else. Lucy grimaced each time the sound of someone pissing in a tin pan echoed through the darkness. In that dark, rustling space, every sense was amplified to a torturous degree. Some of the talkers had clearly been drinking from the way they laughed, their attempts at whispering, their lewd humor, and their frequent piss-pot visits. Paul had told Lucy that alcohol was prohibited. Would he intervene, or was it another counselor's job to tell the idiots to just shut up? Lucy felt close to storming over. It was her first proper night in the crypt, and cabin fever was already setting in. How were these people surviving down here together? As the drunks finally fell asleep, one persistent thought kept Lucy awake. Somewhere in the darkness was Maddie.
"Hold this, will you?" said Paul, thrusting Lucy his jacket as he exited the council's meeting room the next morning. Lucy had been put on guard duty outside the meeting room. Being an impartial party, she was deemed the most suitable candidate to prevent others from eavesdropping on the deliberations and intervening in any way. The council had taken several hours to reach a verdict, and as Paul passed her now, he looked white as a sheet.
"Who's going to do it?" asked Fiona, following closely on his heels. "Who's actually going to go through with it, Paul? Because you know I won't. And neither will half the folk in this town."
"Then I guess it'll have to be someone from the other half," Paul replied, his cheeks sagging as he spoke.
The other counselors came out of the meeting room one by one, all looking equally drained and nauseous. Some had visibly been crying. Lucy stayed close to Paul and Fiona as they led the way back through the main hall. He was sweating profusely.
"Don, Jerry, please go and retrieve Maddie," instructed Paul as he reached the main entrance. "Andrea, I believe Liam is a pastor. Please ask him to meet us there. Monica, any relatives Maddie still has need to be notified. If they want to attend, they'll need to be there in half an hour."
The two women departed. Paul exhaled heavily and rubbed his face.
"I think I need 5 minutes. I'll... excuse me," he said, rushing back towards the corridor.
Lucy stood, gawping at the deserted hall. The only other council member left, the goateed scribe, had slipped off unnoticed. As she shifted Paul's jacket over to her other arm, a jangling noise caught her attention. Lucy threw her eyes around, realizing the significance of that sound. It was now or never. This was her window to escape, to flee the town before it imploded. She couldn't see any other way out. She raced back down to the vault and grabbed her backpack, taking care not to disturb the sleeping night watch crew. Resurfacing, she headed straight onto the street and to Paul's car. Pulling the keys from his jacket, she opened the driver's door and started the engine. The tank was half full. She spun the car around and headed towards a long, straight road pointing out of Wilson, using all her nerve to keep the car at a steady 30, lest the noise of a roaring engine should draw unwanted attention in the silent town. As she turned onto the long, straight road, she passed another car headed the opposite way. It was Andrea, with another man, presumably the pastor. Andrea gawped at Lucy before blaring the horn and gesturing furiously for Lucy to pull over. Lucy hit the accelerator, speed climbing quickly past 60 with no sign of abating. The mid-morning sun bounced off the watchtower as Lucy approached the town boundary. She squinted and watched as the guards turned toward the sound of her engine, one raising a pair of binoculars to his face. She leaned back and flipped the sun visor down, keeping her foot pressed against the floor. The red needle trembled above 90 as she hurtled past the bewildered tower. She glanced in her rearview mirror and watched as the scaffold outpost shrank into the distance. She was free.